Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian, and hope that everybody is having a very happy Father's Day and a happy Father's Day weekend. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. The U.S. COVID death toll is now more than 600,000 as the U.K. eases off its planned reopening, but the European Union has decided to reopen, leaving the decision to actually open borders to each of the member states. The United States, however, does not appear to be opening its borders anytime soon. President Biden had a successful trip to Europe, his first since taking office in January, that included agreement between the United States and the European Union to settle a 17-year running battle between Airbus and Boeing. So between Washington and Brussels over whether aircraft support to aircraft makers constitute illegal subsidies. The World Trade Organization has concluded that both Europe and America are in the wrong. And more bad news for Boeing, this time on its key defense programs. The company wants to delay delivery of the new Air Force One by a year, blaming COVID and a bankrupt interior fittings supplier. While the Air Force has delayed by a year the transition of the company's T-7 trainer that was being touted just a year ago, that trainer being developed delayed in its transition from development to production because of something called wing rock. Fortunately, we have a PhD aerodynamicist here who can help us with that. And the service apparently now is looking for a bridge tanker, given persistent delays in getting the KC-46 Pegasus tanker into service, and a lot of other news on the commercial front with Airbus, as well as CFM International, the partnership between General Electric and Safran, which had an announcement last week, as well as Rise and its open-bladed concept. Many people wondering how that's going to work out. And joining us to discuss the week on world markets, as they do every week, are Dr. Rocket Ron Epstein of Bank of America Merrill Lynch, Sash Tusa of the independent equity research firm Agency Partners, and Richard Abalafia of the Thiel Group Consultancy. Guys, thanks so very much for joining us, and happy Father's Day.
Great to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Thanks so much again, Vago.
Happy Father's Day, Vago. Great to be here.
And I want to congratulate you guys for your weekly contribution that allowed us to win the best digital in the annual Aerospace Media Awards. It's a massive honor. Peter Bradfield and his team do a terrific job. I want to thank the judges. I want to thank you guys for joining us each week with absolutely star-studded commentary. That is the iron core of our commercial aerospace coverage, which is a lifelong passion of mine. I want to thank our producers and all of our contributors over the course of the year, because we do have some of these commercial conversations that go broader than this particular business podcast on a weekly basis. And I want to thank Chris Cervello, my son Alex Maradian, who is a producer or contributing editor, Chris Cavas, all of our sponsors, and particularly our audience here. We couldn't do what we do without you guys listening and being so generous with your time, and appreciating again our sponsors for being so generous with their support. And to that end, before we get started, Leonardo DRS sponsors our global coverage, Northrop Grumman, our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall, Fincantieri, Marinette Marine, our naval coverage, General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy and our Andy Marshall series with leading strategists and thinkers, and General Motors Defense sponsors our technology coverage. So guys, thank you again for joining us and all the work you do on our behalf every week. Ron, start us off. Broader market, good WTO news. What's it all mean?
Yeah, so I don't think the market really cared a heck of a lot about the WTO between Boeing and Airbus. If you look at the group on the week, it's broadly been down. The S&P will be down somewhere around 1.5% most likely this week. And as a bellwether, we look at Boeing. Boeing's down about 4%. The defense stocks are down maybe about half of that, call it 1.5 to 2%, maybe a little bit more in line with the market. So yeah, I mean, it's clearly good news, but the market, I don't think really, it's kind of brushed it off. And maybe that's because over the last 20 years or however long it's been going on, it really hasn't changed all that much in the industry, right? So probably the thinking is on a go forward basis, it won't. But most certainly with what's going on with China, the potential for the C919, it's nice to have, transatlantic cooperation, if you will, in commercial aerospace. when there's emerging competitors in other places. So that's a good thing. Bond yields were down. The 10-year bond yield was down a bit this week. And it just kind of feels like maybe we're starting to finally roll into some of the summer doldrums. So maybe that's where we finally are. Interesting to note, Fridays lately, it seems like the market is taking extended weekends for the last couple of weeks, maybe a month or so, that a lot of people seem to check out on Friday. So it really seems like, Monday through Thursday is the real active trading period in the market. And then Friday, things really seem to quiet down.
And this Friday was the first Friday where there was a national Juneteenth holiday, right? I mean, so that obviously kicks in, first new federal holiday since I think Martin Luther King Day was approved in the United States. Sash, very busy week, obviously, with the WTO news. Very insightful commentary from you on that, as well as looking at the nuances. Air travel in the United States is back up, if not above. Richard, correct me if I'm wrong. On where we were, people are taking extended weekends because people have been cooped up, and now they're increasingly going out for 4-day weekends if they can, or 3-day weekends if they can scotch them. And then we've also got an Airbus program update. Walk us through what you thought was interesting over the week.
Very interesting week for air travel this week. It was the very first week where we haven't had a single negative piece of data. US was up, Europe was up, China was up, Asia was up. And that's a very, very positive sign. Clearly, this is still a domestic travel recovery, but if you've got markets that are big enough, US clearly being the predominant one, but China also, that's going to drag the overall stats up. It was a very encouraging week in that regard. I think what was interesting, though, was that Airbus, at their program update, didn't change and haven't changed at all their forecast, which is for, and they're way beyond the Richard Abulafia school of optimism, because they're saying N23 for a recovery of domestic travel and 2025 for recovery. It was interesting that they didn't take the opportunity of what were pretty good stats this week and have been improving very strongly in the US over the last month and a half, 2 months or so, to be more optimistic about the overall market outlook. As for the WTO, I agree with Ron. I think it's just got to be better to have a transatlantic agreement rather than transatlantic disagreement. The last 4 years, it's been very hard to get anything cooperative or collaborative done. And I think, the only people who've made money out of the WTA has been the lawyers. They have made like bandits. Nobody else has gained a significant position of advantage. No matter what their press releases say, it's been a zero sum game match is wrong, because they've all spent money that they should have been spending on much better things like programs. Our takeaway about the WTO is that, this really does show that the whole sanctions process that was put in place by both sides after the original WTO decisions didn't work. It hurt other parts of the economies, but it didn't actually deliver the change in terms of how the aerospace companies behaved. Second issue, I think, is that it's becoming more obvious now that the next generation of aircraft are going to need development funding and a hell of a lot of support by their respective governments, US and European. And therefore, having a WTA process that says no development support, no subsidies, unfair or otherwise, is just so 20th century. Our view is that really there was a recognition this week that civil aviation is, and civil aerospace is, the stuff of governments. This is what governments do. It generates high-tech jobs, it generates technological advantage, and it generates very, very important exports. And that's actually, it's going to be pretty uncomfortable being, I suspect, in particular, a Boeing director, because there's a form of sort of nationalization that's gone on here. This is the Biden administration saying, we'll take this one now. This is our job. It will get Boeing the funding they need for the next generation airliners, but I think on the US government's terms rather than on anybody else's.
Which I think is very interesting, because Boeing has been extremely resistant, right, to having what it views as U.S. government money, right? I mean, the company chose to go to capital markets as opposed to the government for support at the height of the pandemic. Richard, I want to, you know, kind of pull a little bit on the optimistic string that Sash noted, right? I mean, we've normally been talking about, you know, U.S. Surging, you know, Europe not getting there, but Europe is going to be getting there. You know, a lot of happiness on the part of Americans. Europeans still a little bit frustrated that we're not opening our borders yet for people to come and visit our great land. But talk to us a little bit about some of these dynamics that you're seeing, as well as Airbus's program update, as Sash mentioned.
Yeah, you know, for the umpteenth time, we are fourth quarter 2022 for a full 2019 RPK recovery. And I see IATA, maybe I apologize to Brian Pierce and the team if they've announced this before, but I see this week they started moving their expectation from 2024 to 2023. Even if, as Sash correctly notes, Airbus says not, I'm still sticking with 4Q 2022. And that's a function not just of vaccine administration and efficacy, but also dry powder. Lots of saved up cash in the developed economies, lots of vacation days, and frankly, just a strong willingness and desire to get back on the road. You know, other big events that happened this week, I'd like to touch, if I may, on the WTO subject. Couple of issues.
Please.
You know, one, first of all, I think you have to see it in the broader strategic construct of confronting China, just like Trump did, except this time, rather than deeply annoying allies, working with them. And that's this agreement is clearly part and parcel of that. And I think it's a very promising agreement. You know, basically, I think both sides are sick of having the Chinese play them off against each other in terms of demands for things unrelated to jetliner orders, like, well, move your carrier battle group away from Taiwan, or we'll order a bunch of Airbuses. Or, you know, if you give us a bunch of technology transfer and stop beating up on Huawei, we'll order a bunch of Boeings. You know, both sides are sick of that. Having said that, you know, both the desirability of getting government funding coupled with the desire to be played off by China in exchange for short-term advantage in terms of orders, you could easily see this WTO armistice broken. It kind of reminds me of that moment in Blackadder 4, where the, you know, soldier pops his head out of the trench, hears the shooting has stopped, and says, "My God, it's over. The Great War, 1914, 1917. You know, I mean, it could easily be that this is just a false dawn. But having said that, I think in this strategic context, it's very, very promising and extremely useful. One thing I would disagree with what Sash said is, you know, the possibility of technology development funding happening anyway. Nobody is really talking about this. I mean, it's not just that Boeing walked away from the equity that was offered back last year. It's just that nobody at NASA, or indeed the Europeans, are talking about the kind of, well, cash needed to develop all new jets. Even the much ballyhooed and really by historical terms, quite large French spending package on ESG jetliners is €1.5 billion over a decade. That's a tiny drop in the bucket. And of course, NASA's aeronautics funding is a tiny drop of that. Nobody is considering the idea of government-funded new technology or new program developments. It's just not a thing. So if this WTO armistice does break, it's going to be on the, you know, the prospect of getting the Chinese to order at the expense of the other guy, not because either side wants to take advantage of a huge new pipe of government cash.
Ron, anything you want to add to the WTO discussion and anything else? Because, I mean, with ESG, I think we have to get to Rolls and their net zero statement, and obviously then talk also a little bit about the CFM announcement as well. But Ron, let's take it to you before we kind of go back to the other cats.
Yeah, I'm on board with everything that Richard and Sash said. It just, when you think about ESG, though, I mean, what screams at me, and ultimately it's going to be on the fuel side, as opposed to other technologies, given infrastructure constraints and so on and so forth. But anyway,
Sasha, I want to get your sense, right? Talk to us a little bit about the Rolls-Royce net zero commitment. You know, we just heard from Richard talking about that and the technology, you know, the investment package that the French government is talking about. $1.5 billion sounds great unless you do consider that it's over 10 years. I'm not sneezing on it, right? It's still €1.5 billion. But talk to us a little bit about the significance of what Rolls told us. And since we're talking engine makers, you know, tie in whatever CFM had to announce as well.
Yeah, I mean, look, I would actually argue that the most significant announcement this week was the one from CFM. Rolls talked a lot about net zero, but it was very, very apple pie stuff. Probably the most significant issue or issues that were brought up by Warren East, the chief executive, were firstly that they see the civil the global aviation market as being structurally damaged and hence diminished by COVID-19. They don't see the overall market getting back to where it was before. Now, they would say that, wouldn't they? Because Rolls is wholly focused on long haul, very, very large engines, wide bodies, and a decade long wide body recession is not not a remote possibility. But still, that was the most negative comment that I've heard coming out of an aerospace CEO in Europe for a long time. The second issue, I think, is, you know, what technology is needed to get to net zero. They were very, very cagey about this, and indeed. But I think it's fairly obvious, you know, Rolls is already investing in UltraFan, a geared with a lowercase g turbofan that they hope would be scalable both down to narrow body, a next Boeing aircraft, if that's a mid-body of some sort, and certainly a wide body because it's effectively a geared Trent at the moment. But it's very hard to work out what Rolls can do. I mean, they can get to net zero with their own emissions, their own corporate emissions overall, but that's not the point. The point is, this is a company like GE, like Pratt, like Safran, like MTU, that produces engines that at present burn fossil fuel and generate carbon dioxide and quite a lot of other emissions as well. And they all have to change their business model to do that. So the reason why I thought CFM was so interesting this week, I mean, really interesting, is that they've been the Johnny come lately in this whole process, but they've effectively announced a new engine development program, RISE. That tells us that LEAP, the engine on the 737 MAX and the A320neo, is now in an extended sunset. It's a 15-year program from here. It's not a 25-year program or a 30-year program. It's much shorter dated stock. And their spending is going to go on an all-new open rotor. And I really want to hear what Ron has to say about that, because it's a very differentiated approach compared to UltraFan and compared to the GTF 2.0 that Pratt & Whitney is developing. But it's a huge turnaround for CFM, which has been associated with the CFM56 and its successor, the LEAP.
Ron, do you want to take it at this point from a technological, right, from any of that? And why don't we hear from Ron, and then we can hear from Richard.
Yeah, so just to put some of the previous discussion in perspective, if you look at NASA's requested aeronautics budget for fiscal year 22, it's $915 million. That's right. And if you look out over the next several years, it's, you know, it rises from there. But they, in a 5-year view, they don't get to $1 billion out over 5 years. So, and there's a lot of stuff they're trying to do there. So for perspective, and when you think about open rotors, and I think, you know, Richard can add on to this. It's a technology that's been around for quite some time. You know, it was tried, back in the 80s, if not before. How can I say, on paper, it might look good. In practice, it's far more difficult. You know, all kinds of things. You have, in general, counter-rotating large blades that are extraordinarily loud. So noise is a constraint, as we all know. So you got to get the noise out, which is difficult to do just because of the physics of having the counter-rotating blades. Second thing, where are you going to put it? I think what they were talking about this past week between, you know, Safran and GE, something that's got a radius of maybe 4.5 meters. All right, so you got to find 4.5 meters underneath the wing of a narrow body. That's very difficult to do. Three, by definition, any failure is uncontained, right? So you probably under wing maybe isn't where you want it. You could put it behind the wing, on top of the wing. But the configuration changes pretty dramatically. And then, you know, broadly, and at least in the US, and maybe this is the case in Europe, I don't have as good a feel, people just hate turboprops, right? And this thing is like a turboprop on, you know, Incredible Hulk gamma radiation, right? So it's not even a turboprop on steroids. This is like the mother of all turboprops. So
this is the Godzilla coming out of, you know.
Yes. Yes.
From its nuclear layer.
Yes, well said. It's the Godzilla of turboprops. So, all right. And, you know, that said, however, there might be some interesting technology that can be gained from it in terms of understanding gearing and various different things. So if you look at it as maybe a broader science experiment, technology development program that will have technologies that could be used in a future engine of maybe a different architecture, sure, that maybe makes a ton of sense. But at this vantage point, it's really difficult for me to see that you'd have this technology applied to a commercial aircraft in some sort of reasonable customer accepted way anytime in the next 20 years.
I'm interested in this because obviously turboprops have been around for a very long time. I'm sort of net neutral. They are louder, so I'm sort of curious what, you know, a triple decker turboprop sounds like. And yeah, I mean, people don't like them because they're large spinning blades and you're handling baggage and, you know, next to the airplane, which is why people don't like them. And as to where to put the engines, I suspect you're going to put them high on the wing and in the back. You know, but then, yeah, I mean, there are CG and other issues that come from that. Richard, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a number of big questions about this, much though I do like the initiative. I think, you know, Ron is dead on. You know, I mean, this could be, in terms of technological maturation, you know, how to put this gently, like hydrogen only with more potential collateral damage. You know, I mean, it's going to take a long time for it to play out. And boy, those blades are scary. And they showed it in a configuration that was possibly underwing, which raises all kinds of questions about safety, regulatory, and optics issues. I think the most interesting thing, picking up on Sasha's point about gears, and Ron alluded to this too, you know, maybe we'll learn about gears. This might be yet another decade where GE is a gear denier. And it's not just, of course, with Leap One versus the geared turbofan and now this initiative versus Rolls-Royce's UltraFan. You have to go way back to the sort of golden days of the prop fan, in which you saw the GE36 UDF unducted fan. That was their entry into the prop fan sweepstakes back in the late 80s, which was not geared, versus the Allison Pratt & Whitney 578DX, which was geared. So we have no way, I'm not so sure there's a gearbox here, correct me if I'm wrong, and this could be yet another decade in the half century process of GE saying, we don't need no stinking gears.
that's actually very funny. Sash, you had a question for our august panel. Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm trying to recover from the Richard's description of GE's anti-gear movement. But I mean, actually, it's really a question for, you know, picking up on what Ron said. I fully accept that passengers loathe props for good reasons as well as less good reasons.
Not all of them. I'm a sentimentalist, so airplanes to me look good with propellers on them. So I just, yeah. but go on, continue.
Yeah,
I don't have any anti-prop issue, and I'm not an anti-gearist either. You know,
it is the difference though between what they look like and what it's like when you're exactly in line with the propeller blade tips. I mean, nobody sits in the middle of a C-130 for that reason.
Agree with you, having spent a lot of time on airplanes, and I always loathe being given that seat. But you were saying,
what happens, or what is the trade-off of taking a design like Rise and shrouding it? I.e., you are putting on a very short nacelle, but a nacelle that provides some form of containment and presumably some form of noise attenuation. But you still have the advantage of the fast rotating fan and then the D swirl segment, whatever it's going to be called now. Does that just add horrendous amounts of drag and a huge amount of weight, and you lose all the benefits you got from a rise configuration in the first place? Or is that one possible fix?
No, I mean, I'll just let me jump in. I mean, theoretically, an unducted fan is a engine with an infinite bypass ratio, right? You just go to put the shroud out to infinity. So by putting a nacelle around it of some form, that's a workable solution. I mean, you have to you have to figure out how you're going to mount it and all that sort of stuff. But I mean, that's ultimately in the details. But that is for sure one way you deal with it, right? So kind of back to my point that there's maybe some technology development going on here that could end up in a different form. That very well could be it. So, you know, instead of an unducted fan, it would just be like, you know, the Uber bypass ratio fan or something like that. And then, you know, depending on where, you know, aircraft configurations go, you know, one of the configurations that's been talked about is, you know, a truss-braced wing. Sorry, mouthful for me. And that's a high wing layout for a commercial jet. In that case, if you're putting the wing on top of the airplane and you've got this big truss, it might be something you can do with the truss and the wing and an engine layout that's kind of maybe meaningfully different than what we're used to. Maybe you could make that work too. But then that's taking, it's not just a simple, putting one of these engines on an aircraft platform, how we know it, it would be a different kind of design, not radically different, but different than what we're all used to today.
What are the aerodynamic challenges of that, right? When we have low wing with a sweep, we use high wing for something that's generally in stovall application or for cargo, right?
Yeah, so you can get, it's structural. B, the trust braced architecture gets you a higher aspect ratio, typically lower drag. You can do things like have when you call them like supercritical airfoils, where you can have better transonic flow properties, more laminar flow. There's all kinds of interesting things you can do with it, and that potentially could be a way to go. What gets more complicated is while you're landing gear no longer in the wings, so you got to start putting, right, landing gear pods on and all that sort of stuff. But you look at a C-17, right? That's a high wing jet. Right. So you can do it just fine. But it's a different architecture, right? So you got to go through the whole thing. And the truss itself, it braces the wing, but the truss also has aerodynamic properties. So
Right. I mean, as long as the wetted area is producing lift and not contributing to drag, that's a benefit. Right?
Yep. That's right. And you can get interesting vortex effects. You have counteracting vortices, and they can reduce drag too.
And if I may, I would also point out that per the question of the shroud that Sash asked, the idea of an advanced ducted propeller and all sorts of other configurations have been experimented with over the years. And ironically, it was GE that said, beyond a certain point, these extra big fans produce more weight and drag than they're worth in terms of bypass ratio. So it's interesting to see that maybe this is the only way they could see forward, or maybe that they're reversing themselves.
The thing that I find amazing is Scott Crossfield once, the late great test pilot, told me that of all the data that was collected, the 199 flights of X-15 data, like a small fraction of the data has actually been investigated, which I think is just tragic. So anyway, right, it makes you wonder. I mean, obviously X-15 is not contributing to this, but I put that out as a historical sort of curious note, right? What research have we already done that we have? That's a good question for you, Ron, right? I mean, how much of this aerodynamic research have we done, or that we're just, people have forgotten about, and we have to sort of relearn it at X periods, and then we do have to go and talk about Boeing.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, there's a large body of knowledge of aeronautic research. A lot of it, not, if you want to call it, from modern times, in modern times, meaning call it the last decade, 15 years, where we have computational methodologies that are pretty outstanding for, you know, doing kind of, what do you want to call it, synthetic wind tunnel testing. But there's a humongous library of data out there on, you know, on wing sections, airfoil sections, different layouts, different this, different that, different everything. And, you know, just that, you know, that truss braced wing I talked about. I mean, there's been, you know, a fair amount of work on that. You know, what that means, it's got a higher, you know, higher, at, you know, what do you call it, sweep angle and all that sort of stuff. But so there's a bunch of data out there. But if you think about the direction that, you know, research has gone in aeronautics, it's really been around materials, engines, electronics, just kind of the good old fashioned, being a good old fashioned aerodynamicist, you know, someone that stares at airfoils and, you know, wetted areas and this and that. I mean, there just hasn't been as much work done there in recent history as there has been in other places, just because, right? I mean, there was just more interest in doing other things.
All right. We've got to move to
Boeing. Could I just make a quick last point? Do you mind?
You may just make a quick last point before we get to our Boeing discussion.
Just, you know, one final note on the whole question of rise. You know, it wasn't some kind of technical problem that killed the prop fans of the 80s. It was fuel prices. Fuel prices get a vote here too. And if they go back down and stay in the, you know, 50 and or 60 and less zone, then prop fans lose a lot of their appeal.
Got it. Right. Boeing. June 9, Dave Calhoun, you know, made clear that the new Air Force One would be delayed. Unlike past Air Force Ones, it is not being built from scratch as a presidential aircraft, but was an aircraft that was a whitetail that was then, well, right, it had been sold, an order had been canceled, and they were sitting around remanufacturing. The company said COVID, as well as the bankruptcy of an interior company, is what is prompting the delay. This comes when the Air Force says that the T-7 trainer, for wing rock reasons, will be delayed by a year, going from development into production. That was a program that Air Force leaders, including former Air Force acquisition executive Will Roper, were touting as a you know, leap ahead program, an E designation, E for electronically designed aircraft. And now we have the Air Force talking about a bridge tanker on KC-46. And if you talk to people, knowledgeable folks in the industry, they maintain that these past performance issues may already be dissuading Boeing from bidding on other defense work, that these contractors see Boeing not bidding, which means that this bitter fruit will be harvested for a long, long time. Ron, start us off. What is wing rock? And sure. what does all of this mean taken in its totality, right? You could say it's only a 1 year delay, but it appears every program is in trouble. And then you've got the F-18. Congress may intervene again and buy airplanes, right? So that's life support. And then on P-8, there is sort of an understanding, this is a 25-year-old airplane that is not really effective at its core mission, and we're already like 10 or 15 years into the program, right?
Yeah. So, you know, a couple of comments and some things that we've spoken about before on the podcast. It really makes you scratch your head about what is going on in the engineering organization at the Boeing company and what top down is going on to address it. There's no way that you have issues across, you know, the list goes on. So, you know, there's no point in kind of counting it off on my two hands. There's more than 10. So that has to be addressed on an absolutely fundamental level. What's going on in the engineering organization has to be addressed. Richard will probably mention, you know, they've cut back spending on R&D and so on and so forth. All right, well, be that as it may, you can't continue to have these problems, or ultimately, like you said, the chickens do come home to roost. Wing rock. Well, you know, wing rock. Say that 10 times fast. Is a tricky issue, because what it is typically you're at a higher angle of attack, and you'll get essentially one wing to stall, and then what'll happen, the other one won't. One wing will stall, and then it'll, you know, kind of fall off, and then it'll get lift again, and then the other side stalls, and then the other side stalls. And it's just, so the cycle happens. So the airplane actually rocks because you have this, sinusoidal stalling from side to side to side to side. Now, the bad news is it's highly nonlinear, right? So trying to build a control system to control it or deal with it can be really, really tricky, right? It reminds me of back in the day when I was working in the industry, there was something with the F-18ENF called wing drop. You're at a higher angle of attack at a slower speed, approaching a carrier maybe, and all of a sudden one wing would just stall. It's a, you know, a sister malady to that. And that was a tricky fix. It could be a year, could be longer, who knows, but this is basic aerodynamics. And it comes back to, you know, the wing thickness, the airfoil they used, if there's some sort of, you know, geometry cut they did somewhere, but it has to do with some of the very, very fundamental aerodynamics of the wing.
We should point out, right, the wing flutter issue on the tanker, the problem was kind of a complicated, it was a complicated structural and aerodynamic problem, which magnified it, right? The stiffeners in the wing changed the elasticity. That in turn, as I recall with, that was a problem with the Italian jets. They had given where they had put the hose and reel pods on the upward edge of the wing. Go ahead.
Said lovingly. I mean, the 767s kind of got floppy wings, right? It's a flexible airplane.
Right.
And, you know, it wasn't ever really set up to do a lot of what it's doing as a tanker. And you can get a very complex interplay between the aerodynamics and the structure of the plane. Just as a counterpoint, if you look at the A330, right? A330, A340 sister airplanes with a common wing, that wing was designed to carry four engines. There's a lot of structure in that wing. And that wing lends itself well to have, if you only got two engines on it, you can put other things on it because you got the stiffness and it's not as floppy, for the lack of better scientific words, as the wing on the 7.6.
Yes, it's not as noodly, although I think the A380 wins the all-time award for noodliness net. You know, whenever the airplane is taking off, especially you're on a heavily loaded airplane, you're like, man, there's a lot of stuff moving out there. Okay, let me... Richard, let me bring you in, right? What does this mean as you go downstream, right? I mean, there is an engineering impact to this, but then there's a real world financial impact, especially if, and again, I mean, these are isolated data points. These are other people in the industry who are surmising that there is a reason why Boeing is not pursuing contracts. That's not to say that the company is still not doing good work. Richard, I want to start with you, and then I want to get Sasha's take, right? If you're looking at this downstream from a strategic business standpoint, again, these are isolated data points, but people in the industry are suggesting that Boeing may not be pursuing work in part because it's got bad past performance grades, which are very, very important for contractors, right? And that has knock-on effect. Now, in fairness to Boeing, the company is still a tremendous company. It still produces great products. And apparently has had some success in the classified area, which are noteworthy. But sort of give us your sense on what all of this means. And you know, Sash, I want to get your take on this as well, right? The T-7 is a program that involves the Swedes, was regarded as a key discriminator in this as well, in part because Saab is a real frontline airplane company that's got a very good batting average in terms of the aircraft it's involved with. But ultimately, if folks are seeing Boeing as something other than a top flight engineering company, that has effects that go beyond just commercial, on defense. But, you know, the company has its commercial challenges and it's kind of across the board, as Ron said. So I just want to get your sense on this latest chunk of news flow.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever thought this in 34 years of following the industry, but no, this approach to management is completely wrong. It all needs to change. It went down a wrong path under McNerney. I think Ron has said something like this. I think Sash has said something like this. I think we're probably, if I may speak for all of us, in d'accord, as our French friends say, this is all wrong. The position of engineering and technical people, and there are many good ones at Boeing, within the context of management is just all completely wrong. And the data points are blowing up in our face. you know, if Tim Clark is right about 777X, that might be yet another truly monumental disaster. It's not just a question of competitiveness moving forward. It's survival on the basis of stuff they've committed to and are very poorly executing on. And this brings up the intrinsic point of the T-7 contract itself. Never forget that if KC-46 was a very aggressive, very sporty contract, T-7 was, yes, it was, to use Ron's metaphor, it was the Japanese monster movie monster of contracts. This was a should cost of about $16.2 billion, if memory serves, and they came in with $9.7 and said, we can do it with the magic of digitization. That appears to be blowing up. So KC-46, I think we're, where are we, $5 billion in overruns borne by Boeing and probably more to come. You can expect something on this on that scope here, certainly in the billions. Repeat as many times as necessary, you know, lather, rinse, repeat. None of this looks good. And all of it, not least of which, of course, is the 737 MAX issue. You know, all of this reflects, I think, very poorly on the managerial culture and where it puts engineers in terms of how it empowers them and allows them to ask for, you know, schedule changes or resource additions or whatever else. All of this is very, very wrong. I'll stop there.
As we've discussed, right, I mean, this is a survival issue fundamentally, right? Not only are you going to pay more to execute what you're doing, but then you actually may be making decisions already, or rather the customer is making decisions or pushing you to make decisions that will also have, you know, I mean, you're out business, you're not even competing for it, right? So, I mean, that's billions of dollars in opportunities you don't have access to. Sash, your sense as somebody who's been watching the game for a long time and this company in particular?
I'll just make sort of 2 points from a European standpoint. I mean, first of all, I really hope that Saab is not a full risk sharing partner on the T7. You remember they do a huge chunk of the center and rear fuselage, and they've delivered all of their both their prototype fuselages and their pre-production or LRIP fuselages absolutely to time and to specification. So they've done their bit, but I really hope they're not a full risk sharing partner, because the company is just too small to be able to cope with the sort of overrun that Boeing seems to be able to write itself into. So, you know, that does make me worried for Saab. And I think they're going to have to address this to their investors. I think as far as the, you know, tanker is concerned and KC-46 and all of its troubles, Airbus will be loving the opportunity to rebid the A330 MRTT for what, you know, it was originally referred to as KCY. They've got a tanker that works, that is in service with half a dozen nations and has been ordered by half a dozen more. The boom occasionally falls off, but that could happen to anybody. It's a very, very, very good design. And it has the great advantage from the point of view of the US Air Force that it is, it doesn't have the same risk. It's undifferentiated, it's got a different set of risks to anything that you're going to get with KC-46. And that's a very, very good thing for the Air Force at the moment.
And before we part for the week, this is a very important question. We are not trying to be ad hominem critics of Boeing. It's a great company that has tremendous heritage, tremendous people, some of whom are very, very good friends of ours. And we're doing this because it is a global treasure that's in grave risk. We've hoped that management was going to recognize these risks. What is it going to take for, and Ron, let's start with you and very quickly just go through the line, right? Because I know that you've discussed this with Boeing management at a very senior level. What's it going to take to trigger the kind of change required? Because literally the future of the company is really in the balance, and we have seen this throughout history of great dominant names just sliding off the plate.
I think it's going to have to be, it's going to have to be recognized more by the equity markets, right? I mean, you know, so far in a way, the equity markets have given them a pass, but not completely. If you look at many other aerospace names, They've recovered to 2019 levels, pre-pandemic levels, particularly, you know, kind of marquee names in the space. You know, Boeing hasn't, but if you look at Boeing on a enterprise value basis, where you include the debt and equity, it's almost there. But you know, for I think the board to wake up, and for other people to recognize it, it's probably going to be driven by market performance, right? So if the market comes marching up with the pick, you know, the pitchforks out and the flames, then maybe that'll force some change. But it's hard to see it happen until you get a broader recognition from the market that there's a systemic issue.
Sash?
I agree with Ron on that. I think that the market will drive it. I don't see the current management with the current lack of pressure, i.e., you know, the current share price, doing the right things fast enough. And actually, there's a real sense of urgency, or there should be a real sense of urgency. And I just don't see it yet.
Richard?
I'm, to be honest, not even as optimistic as Ron. It just seems that the current top level management is going to keep rallying around the idea that, hey, when things get back on track, we keep converting cash flow into dividends and buybacks. So just be patient with us and that'll be fine. They might, in other words, they might be able to escape the ire of the equities mob by using that argument. And that'll just, you know, postpone the day of reckoning. Or it could be that this is the start of a very serious emergency. And as Ron says, it does take the ire of the equities markets to make them realize. But boy, there doesn't appear to be even the remotest bit of self-awareness. I mean, you know, the idea of blaming that whole report that blamed two test pilots for what happened with the MAX, you know, their answer to Ron's question, how did this happen, was, oh, two bad test pilots. I mean, seriously? And now on top of that, you've got this very broad pattern of programmatic disasters. You know, I think any other management team might say, we need a lot more engineering and technical people on the board. That hasn't happened. We need a much greater level of buy-in of engineers and technical people at all levels of the organization. That certainly hasn't happened. If self-recognition and self-awareness hasn't happened now, I'm not really sure what does make it happen.
Guys, thanks very much for joining us. We really appreciate it. Thanks very much again for all your contributions to our success. We appreciate it very, very much. Have a very good Father's Day and a great week, and look forward to having you guys back on again next week. Thanks very much.
Always a pleasure to be here, Vago. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you, Vago, and congratulations to you.
Yeah, thanks, Vago, and great work, and thanks for including us in your terrific program.
You guys are the reasons we're a success, and we appreciate it very, very much. Thanks to all of you again, and look forward to continuing the partnership. Thanks a lot.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.